Work session of the Portland City Council. Today we're going to hear from the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, the Bureau of Development Services, Portland Parks and Recreation. We'll take a brief break at 11:30, then we'll come back from the Bureau of Emergency Communications and then the Portland Bureau of Emergency Management. With that, I'll turn it over to Director Scott.
I have nothing to add this morning. Thank you, Mayor.
Very good. So we'll start with the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, Director E.
Okay, thank you. Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners, Budget Advisors, City Colleagues, and community members. My name is Sukri. I serve as Director for the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. And I have a lot to cover in this short amount of time, and so I'm going to jump right in. And if I have a tendency to also speak very quickly, so if you just need me to slow down, please just let me know. I'll start with this quote from Lewis Carroll. If you don't know where you're going, then any road will lead you there. Today's budget conversation will be wide-ranging. We'll talk about graffiti and communications, disability, and cannabis. And so I would take the first part of the presentation to let you know that where we are going as a bureau. Is this actually helpful? Okay. Where we're going as a bureau is actually best represented by ONI's long-term goals. And by sharing these goals, I hope to answer many of the questions about alignment with the mayor and council priorities and the risks and core investments needed to achieve equitable outcomes. ONI's long-term goals also help us understand how the parts add up to a greater whole. The first slide is a very simplistic representation of ONI's mission in service of the mayor and council priorities. The point I make here is that these priorities are actually jointly held by the community, bureaus across the city, and the council. Realistically, the only way to increase housing options, enhance livability, increase public safety, and strengthen resiliency is in partnership with the community. And many bureaus partner with the community, of course, but ONI is the only bureau for whom it is the sole mission. The next slide, please. The next slide actually has our mission, and the words are pleasant enough: to promote a culture of civic engagement by connecting and supporting all Portlanders, working together and with government to build inclusive, safe, and livable neighborhoods and communities. However, every single word in this mission statement is contested. The reality is that we do not share the same worldviews, and we do not have the same starting points, and that is why investing in this mission is paramount, because we do have an interdependent and shared future. And the who needs to agree changes every day. The majority of Oregonians in 2016 were born outside of the state. Millennials outnumber baby boomers in America as of 2015, and the generation behind the millennials, our children in kindergarten and elementary school today, have been majority minority since 2014. So we are rich in our diversity, and we are experiencing the forces of urbanization. So many people embrace these changes, and some others feel like it is too much, too fast. And it's not just about density or skylines. Our diversity and urbanization challenges very basic concepts of what it means to belong and what we can expect of each other and of our government. So if we only invested in roads and pipes and parks, all very necessary things, but not in the social and community infrastructure to bring Portlanders together in the democratic process, then these goals of livability, public safety, equity, and resilience will be elusive. Next slide, please. So ONI's long-term goals speak to this, and there are three. The first we're calling structures for inclusion. Each significant act of inclusion does not guarantee that the next act will follow. I'll share with you an example. When did women get the right to vote? Anyone? 1920. The question is actually better asked, which women? Because in 1920, with the 19th Amendment, white women received the right to vote. But it took the Voting Rights Act of 1965 for African-American women to actually exercise the franchise. And for women ages 18, 19, and 20, it took the 26th Amendment in 1971 to be able to have the right to vote. The example is to make the point that structures themselves can be designed for inclusion. It is possible to build into the DNA of institutions to regularly ask who is included, who is excluded, and then what has changed about our basic assumptions about inclusion. So ONI will model this in our own work, and we hope to be the bureau that helps to change institutional practices across the city. One way we will do this is by flipping our own complaint-driven models, especially in our livability center, noise control, graffiti abatement, and liquor licensing. These programs are not currently designed to ask who is not served. We will move to more proactive functions that represent the data of real need and opportunity, and also reflecting the languages, cultures, and realities of diverse communities. This thing is too close. And as good as government can be, truly inclusive structures are always in partnership with the community. So we cannot neglect to invest in the infrastructure for community building and civic engagement. Just as the city functions with bureaus and departments, community life is organized through community-based groups, faith centers, neighborhoods, language, common experiences, and more. Especially for communities that are not well served currently by government, we need to invest in their ability to partner with the city toward city and council priorities, especially around equity. Our second long-term goal is called adaptive governance. Issues confronting communities have always been complex, but the way that we take on complexity in government does not always reflect this. Our form of government splits up budgets, authority, and responsibility across bureaus. The way we decide is often 50% or more, which is another way of saying that we are equally divided. And success is often defined as having to be measurable and concrete, which makes us focus on incremental efforts to be practical. And this is not a judgment. This is just a description of our reality. But many communities refuse to fit into neat and separate formats, even though they have to use these processes effectively. For example, today's reality of climate change requires cross-issue, cross-constituency organizing. We see this in local efforts like the Portland Just Energy Transition. This coalition brings together the leadership of movements that refuse to be separated: women's, racial justice, environmental, faith, and more. For ONI, we'll be redesigning our programs to ask how we can better invest in bringing people together around issues of common concern, while recognizing that they and we often have organized them through single identities such as neighborhoods, communities of color, youth, disability, and elders. Housing or income inequality, for example, are issues that cannot be addressed by single perspective alone. Also, as a city, we keep asking ourselves, how can bureaus work better together on citywide concerns? ONI will partner more and more with bureaus, not just in one-off projects, but take on efforts that make it a citywide practice to have shared goals that make it into multiple bureaus' budgets, metrics, and measures for accountability. Those are some of the examples of what we mean by adaptive governance. Our third goal is called Fulfilled and Empowered Portlanders. On this, I simply want to say communities empower themselves, and our role can be to support their ability to work together and with their government. And there are too many communities that have a minimal relationship with the city, and that is our collective loss. As a city, we can get to a mindset and a reality of everyone in and sharing the benefits of the system with as many as are willing to join. But with the ideas, similar as with the ideas of livable, safe, and inclusive, the idea of everyone in is also contested. Some have told me, even as recently as last night at a meeting, that this sounds like they will get less and that bringing more people in will dilute all our issues. I do not cater to this thinking, but I do think the outcome is that everyone gets something different. How we equitably share and invest resources is the right conversation, and they're very challenging. ONI will be investing more time and attention toward how we have these public conversations about equitable outcomes, acknowledging our different starting points and our different experiences of respect. Our next slide is just a simple graphic of the at least 16 programs that ONI is pleased to house, and the effort to put our mission and our long-term goals at the center. Again, if we don't know where we're going, any road will lead you there. The next slide, please.
In the future, could you give us, I mean, after this, could you give us a bigger one of that? Because even looking at it on the screen, I couldn't see what was written in the 16 spots. So if you could give us a full-size page, that would be really helpful. Thank
you. That would be great. I would do that.
You need to push the microphone away from you a little bit.
I know. It seems like...
Thank you. The distance. You're right. There's writing. Thank you. You can see that. So, the next slide, please.
So ONI's long-term goals reflect strategic thinking, not only a set of decision points, and our strategic choices are on the slide, and I only briefly refer to the second one, investing in the leadership and the community infrastructure for 2035. The next slide, please. I'm not going to speak to the metrics, but the metrics, the bureau-wide metrics are listed here. We also have metrics for every program, but bureau-wide metrics help us tell a bigger story for the for our collective efforts. The next slide. This brings us to our priority for decision packages, and there are two for ongoing support, strategic communications and East Portland. I am not, in this prepared presentation, speaking to our reduction packages. I hope that the budget summary has presented our rationale fairly, and I'm happy to answer any questions about our budget cut recommendations in the question and answer sessions. Strategic communications. This request addresses so many areas of ONI's ability to deliver equitable outcomes. It addresses also two of ONI's greatest risks. The first risk is not examining the assumptions and evidence informing our work, and the second risk is our inability to effectively communicate with the community as it is now and the emerging majority that is already here. So strategic communications for ONI is not just about news releases, Willamette Week, websites, or Twitter. For ONI, it will be examining the assumptions that inform our efforts as we reach new audiences that may or may not share our same worldviews and assumptions. For example, this generation of youth leaders, the ones that just marched on City Hall on Wednesday to protest gun violence, is the first to have grown up with mass shootings, and also with concepts like trauma-informed, transgender, social media, and legal recreational cannabis. Their assumptions, ways of communicating and relating to government are shaped by forces different than many others. I am so excited to learn from their leadership. They are now or soon will be our leaders, voters, employees, employers, entrepreneurs, and future city council candidates. I use the example of youth, but you could tell a similar story for non-English speakers, people who have moved to Oregon from a different part of the country, elders, people with disabilities, long-timers, and others. There are many, many equity dimensions. We cannot serve if we do not communicate, and we cannot communicate well with diverse communities if we do not first examine our own assumptions. Strategic communications will have a direct impact on our basic ability to be relevant, and it affects all areas of our programming and administrative functioning. Our second priority is support for East Portland. I do not believe that I need to restate the importance of East Portland for the council or for this audience. In brief, though, East Portland represents 28% of Portland's population and 40% of our kids. East Portland has many, many community strengths, such as their diversity, but they have more than their fair share of challenges, including more than 50% being rent burdened. This request represents ongoing and one-time support. The first investment is in the people who do the work of engaging 179,000 East Portlanders. Our East Portland neighborhood office functions today with only part-time staffing, totaling only 2.275 FTE. They accomplish a tremendous amount, but I have to say this is simply wrong. Our request brings the staffing to 4 full-time positions. It realigns existing general fund dollars to make the director and the program specialist full-time, And there is a request for ongoing support to increase the community information outreach staff position to full-time and add another full-time specialist. The second investment for East Portland is to keep East Portland Neighborhood Office housed. We will have to move out, but not at our own initiative. We will be losing our lease for very good reasons, and we are currently involved in a facility search for our team at the Kelly Building, and so we know that in East Portland, you can reasonably expect to invest up to $20 per square foot for office and community space. This amounts to $56,000, although there is an error in the budget, and it is only showing $28,000. The $28,000 was our first estimate. The current leaseholder is the Portland Water Bureau, and they will need to charge market rate rent, and their projection was $28,000 for the coming year. But investing in East Portland is not just paying for rent. This is an opportunity to create a true community asset. It would be investing in the community infrastructure that serves, again, 179,000 East Portlanders. The third investment for East Portland is modest program support through one-time funds. Of course, we need people to do the work, but the community also needs resources to fuel their community-led efforts. That one-time support is requested at $40,368. An additional priority that is important to note is to staff at 1.0 FTE the advisory boards and commissions work that the City Council passed through Resolution 37-328 just recently in November. That resolution brings important and overdue reforms to our city's advisory bodies. ONI was named as the lead agency to implement those changes, and we were instructed to ask for this position and funding support in the budget process. We also have, the next slide, please, priorities for our one-time ask, resources to invest in efficiencies to achieve long-term savings. These two asks are for the Disability Program Equity Indicators Data Collection Project and the database projects. Around the Disability Program Equity Indicators data collection work, the local data on people with disabilities is very, very inconsistent or non-existent, out of date or not disaggregated. But on average, about 15 to 20% of the population will be persons with disabilities, and they are members of every age group, every racial and ethnic group, and every socioeconomic group. As Council receives budget presentations in the coming weeks, it might be instructive to ask bureaus whether they can identify who they serve by disaggregated by disability. Note if they can and if they can disaggregate with other identities and how this information has helped them engage this population. We would use these funds to partner with a community-based organization or researcher to examine and compile data around communities with disability with an emphasis on equity and community engagement rather than just service provision. And we would hope to gather and share this data across bureaus and across the region with other community organizations. Our second one-time ask is to invest in our database. We have two technology projects that affect nearly all areas of bureau functioning. The first is online payments. I won't go too much into this except to say I recently bought a box of cookies on a street corner from a Girl Scout with a credit card and a square. I would just like for ONI to have the same capacity as our local Girl Scout troops. Last year, we processed 6,843 payments from noise, liquor, and cannabis programs. All of those business owners, community members, had to print something out, find a stamp, or drive into City Hall to pay that fee. We will always have in-person options, and there will always be need for cash handling for programs such as cannabis. But that percentage, for example, the cannabis needs, is less than 10% of our total transactions. Regarding our ONI database, we have reached the limits of our homegrown database. These funds will go right back to the city, to Bureau of Technology Services, to purchase their services for a business need assessment with all our teams and to determine whether our system can take us any further. Finally, there's a new decision package that ONI and our commissioner in charge is requesting for your consideration. The request is for ONI's cannabis program to receive one-third of the anticipated cannabis tax revenue to administer funds for related to small business support and restorative justice initiatives. We are requesting these funds to serve the voters' intent for how the tax revenue should be used, which is for drug and alcohol education and treatment, public safety, and support for neighborhood small businesses, especially women and minority-owned businesses. This ad package is related to the cannabis tax revenue and therefore should not have bearing on ONI's general fund request. Per the current code, oversight of the total tax cannabis revenue will remain with the budget office and revenue, but we feel that the responsibility for administering these funds would be better housed in a bureau. We thank the efforts of the staff of Commissioner Fritz and Udaly for managing this work this previous year, but moving forward, these efforts might be better housed in a bureau. The cannabis program is the obvious home and administrator for such a task in light of ONI's reimagined goals, but also cannabis has a new vision for itself that includes being informed continually by regulation and public safety, but also focusing on equity and community involvement and supporting locally owned sustainable cannabis businesses. The program also can and should serve as the hub for cannabis policy. The program already engages the industry, including minority cannabis business owners, and has a mechanism for policy oversight through the Cannabis Policy Oversight Team and already advises legislative policies with the Office of Government Affairs. We already have working relationships with other bureaus, and we would welcome a relationship with Prosper Portland to support small businesses. And there is a future expectation that there will be council work sessions annually to discuss allocations per the code, and the cannabis program would expect to be included in this meeting. So these are our long-term goals. This is the general direction for ONI as a bureau moving forward. These are our priority asks for one time and ongoing support. And now I would love to answer any questions you may have.
Commissioner Saltzman.
Oh, thanks. Could you discuss the rationale for the Elders in Action cut? Mm-hmm.
We talked about the need to build more inclusive structures, and we also, in our long-term goals, and we ONI as a bureau takes the responsibility for not better integrating the thinking and the needs of elders into our programming holistically. As a cut recommendation, we also looked at the when you ask a bureau like ONI that is not robustly funded and have one-person programs and yet has a very big mission, it's like asking someone who has whether they would like to cut out sleep or work or exercise or friendship or food in their day. It is not an easy recommendation. But this program has the fewest interdependencies with the other areas of our work, and it has the least impact on our staffing, and staffing is an important consideration for ONI moving forward in its ability to meet all of the aspects of our mission. So we'd also like to question the assumption whether $160,000 in general is enough to fund elder services for the entire city. We believe that at this point, it is at the end of a 10-year contracting period. It is the right time to take a pause, re-examine our own assumptions about how we can serve this population, and what is the level of resources that need to be invested, and what is the model that we need for going forward.
So if I could dive in on that, Commissioner. yes, it's a good time at the end of the contract. However, getting rid of the money means that we don't have the funding anywhere in the city. So I will be advocating for, if we're going to reevaluate the contract, that's fine. But we're supposed to be an age-friendly city. We already underinvest in that program. So I think the appropriate thing to do would be to keep the money in ongoing funding and have that discussion about where does it live rather than cutting it.
If I could just piggyback on that in the context of graffiti. My assumption, based on reading the analysis of the CBO, is that it is not that ONI feels like city graffiti abatement is not a worthwhile endeavor that should be pursued through the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. That's correct? I mean, you think ONI should be doing this work, right?
ONI should and could, but there are other models that we could explore. And if you would like for me to share with you what some of them are. For example, the city of Baltimore does graffiti abatement through their sanitation program in a program that's very similar to Metro's regional illegal dumping program. Then they also pick up dumped items. The city of Seattle does it through public utilities. San Francisco's program is also through public works. San Diego's program is through streets. There are many models.
Rob, if and I could so, just jump in then. So how much volunteer coordination of graffiti abatement does ONI now do? Because the reason it was in ONI before is it was used as a community engagement tool. Is ONI still doing volunteer cleanups, or could we put it in OMF and have it just done by contract?
ONI does, there are many models you can use to address this that could be also multi-bureau partnerships. Currently, we have contractor services, and we also use our FTE for community cleanups using volunteer support. So as a percentage of the FTE, I would have to get back to you on the exact percentage. But of course, if the graffiti abatement program is housed within ONI, we will also help to ensure that it creates a culture of civic engagement and engages volunteer efforts.
Yeah, if you could give us a report on the past year, how many cleanups have been done involving community members versus contracted, that would be helpful.
Yes.
Yeah, just to piggyback on that, I'm a co-chair of the Safety and Livability Committee in the Northwest District Association, and I have participated myself on cleanups related to graffiti in the past, and I worry that moving it into one of these other models could end up with a result that lessens civic engagement and community engagement related to cleanup activities, which is a way to get people in the door and thinking about their neighborhoods in a way that encourages participation.
It's also a lot easier than pulling ivy, I would have to say, because it stays away a bit longer, at least you hope it does. I have a question about, you mentioned about East Portland and the Water Bureau property. Do the folks in East Portland want to move from the current location?
It was not something that we initiated, but as the opportunity has been raised, it has led us to consider maybe longer organizational development and community ideas. And so the facility itself, first of all, we really appreciate the Water Bureau's support of actually it's East Portland Neighbors, which is a nonprofit that has invited East Portland Neighborhood Office to be a guest in that facility. But the facility is not ideal. It is unreinforced masonry, and the layout is not quite office or community center. So if we can imagine a better space for community engagement support, that long term, this opportunity has raised that question for us that actually are probably better locations to pursue long term.
Well, I will be looking for East Portland's input on that. I mean, because the other option is having the general fund buy the building from the Water Bureau rather than paying $50,000 a year, which very quickly I believe would buy it.
The Water Bureau has been very generous in thinking of options and being creative with us. Without speaking for them, one of the options they have considered for that site is actually to get rid of it. It is not necessarily the best building to keep investing in. There's deferred maintenance issues, and as a site, it may not be structurally the most sound property.
Another question.
I'll get to Frieda, then back to Dan.
We're going to stay on East Portland and the allocation. The auditors did a report which shows how EPNO is grossly underfunded.
Yes.
And I know the CBO is not necessarily recommending the additional funds. Should you not get the additional funds, what are your plans to equalize the funding?
Mm-hmm. So we've already had this conversation with the cohort and neighborhood coalition directors and chairs, and our best case scenario is the one that we're recommending in our budget proposal. And if that is not received favorably, then the coalition directors and ONI, we're prepared to have the conversation about funding equity. So, but first things first, we need to share with you what we think are the right and better investments and make that case, but the coalition directors and ONI are prepared to have that funding equity conversation.
Well, you've had the funding equity conversation, what, has it been almost 2 years that that audit report was done? I know it was in the last year's budget regarding this issue. Have you considered, I'm on a school board, so I've been on for years, and one of they did when they equalized funding in the state was to take a few years so that, like, PPS and Park Rose, who were highly funded above David Douglas, things equalized. Mm-hmm. We weren't given any more money necessarily, but you equalized and took a year or two to do it. I think your discussions have gone on long enough and that the idea should be to equalize. So this year, a small portion would shift. Mm-hmm. Next year, another portion until it was fully equalized, because the budget is limited, and though the best-case scenario for the other coalitions is to have additional funding for EPNO, I don't think it changes. What the issue is right here is that most of the population has shifted to East Portland in the last 10 years, but everyone's ignored the funding regarding that. And had they did the shifting over as the population shifted, there wouldn't be this gross inequity right now.
Agreed. I appreciate your comments, and I do agree that the conversation has gone on for too long. But I would say that in having this conversation now under my tenure, we're adding a couple more things. The first is that we actually need to talk about equity, to what end and to what outcomes. And that's why our long-term goals has been really important, to set the stage of not just equity on paper, but really to what end. I also want to add another layer of thinking to the equity conversation going forward. And it's not just an everyone knows equity is not necessarily equal. Where there's need and opportunity and underinvestment, sometimes you have to overinvest. I think that concept also needs to be brought to this conversation. So it's not just about everyone getting per capita funding per head, but really we need to examine chronic long-term underinvestment, and in some cases we need to make the case for overinvestment where we've historically neglected to do so. So
I don't disagree with you, but the first step would be to equalize the funding, and then you could look at the extra needs that East Portland have, given the immigrant population. They have a much higher need for translation and interpretation than most of the other coalitions. So to me, equalizing, then you add. But you've got to get equal before you're not going to jump from being grossly underfunded to suddenly being giving extra in one big step. At least I don't see that happening in a budget process.
Yes.
And because of limited funds.
That is very welcome feedback.
Very good. Commissioner Saltzman.
I realize this isn't part of the general fund, but the cannabis regulatory program. So there is a small business supports aspect of that. And you mentioned Prosper Portland. I guess I'm curious, have you given any thought to simply developing an intergovernmental agreement with Prosper Portland and let them do the small business support, given how difficult it is for businesses to access who does what in government? Is that what's going on?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay, great.
Thank you, Commissioner Fritz.
Okay. Commissioner Fritz.
On that issue of cannabis tax, I support your proposal, Commissioner Udaly. Are you planning to have a work session this year to allocate the tax?
That would be my preference.
I agree.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Sook. First of all, I just, in the interest of time, I'm going to keep this really brief, but I want to affirm my support for these ad package priorities and the budget cuts with a few caveats. One, I would love to talk to my colleagues about Elders in Action because I do support that organization. I don't want to see them suffer, but I think we need to talk about where they should live and how they should be funded and whether having one organization do this work year after year after year is the appropriate approach. Communications is absolutely vital. I can't believe the Bureau has been functioning without adequate communications support, and I was disappointed to see that not recommended by CBO. Similarly, the advisory boards and commissions position. ONI has been had responsibilities thrust upon them without adequate resources, without extra funding, without added FTE, and we had to take someone doing already doing vital work in our Bureau and redirect them to do this. So if we're not going to get that position funded, we are not going to be able to do that work because we cannot go without that other position business.
It's a management analyst.
Management analyst position. And that's all I have to say right now.
Very good. And did you have one more, Rob?
Just real quickly, I'm intrigued by the idea of having a sort of broader conversation about how graffiti abatement can be undertaken by places. I understand that other bureaus don't even abate on their own property, so I'm hoping that that might be a sort of a very small part of the citywide conversations that are taking place. Because if we're going to be doing it, if we're engaging citizens to do it, it seems like a little bit hypocritical for bureaus not to be doing it on their own property.
Yeah, I agree that we could use a much more holistic approach because, as you know, we're not allowed to clean up graffiti on certain types of property. So, yeah.
Very good. So, again, I apologize. This always feels like speed dating, and I know we could ask each of these directors lots more questions. So, remembering, you know, this is dipping our toes in the water. And gives us some idea of the Bureau's thoughts vis-a-vis the CBO's thoughts. So I appreciate everybody understanding that we have an aggressive timeline. Thank you, Director Reed, for your excellent presentation. Next up, we have the Bureau of Development Services. And we're a little over, so any director who can save a little time, that's always helpful.
Gets a cookie.
We'll save you time. We'll be fast. Rebecca
no,
Esau.
You don't have to, but it's helpful if you can.
Ours is pretty straightforward. I'm Rebecca Esau. I'm the director of the Bureau of Development Services. With me today is Elshad Hajiev, our senior business operations manager, and Kyle O'Brien, the budget and finance manager at BDS. We've had a lot of changes in the last year at BDS, but our mission remains the same for promoting safety, livability, economic vitality through efficient and collaborative application of building development codes. Just a quick budget overview. Our focus in addressing the mayor's priorities is increasing housing options and enhancing livability, as well as addressing customer and community needs in several ways. Those include filling staff vacancies and adding positions through the spring bump, reorganizing the Bureau to include developing new programs as well as increased timeliness of our services, and moving forward with the electronic plan review and our technology project. Our budget request has support from the development industry and the community, including DRAC, the Financial Advisory Committee, and the Bureau and the Budget Advisory Committee. Regarding the housing options, increasing housing options, and the housing crisis we're in, we've been partnering with PHB, providing priority service to PHB-funded affordable housing projects. We've been implementing the mayor's fast-track permitting pilot, and we've been working on an R enforcement program, which supports preservation and maintenance of existing housing stock. Additionally, we've been partnering with the Joint Office of Homeless Services with locating warming centers and mass shelters. And we've been working with Commissioner Udaly and the directors of the bureaus that have SDCs to bring a proposal to you this spring related to SDC waivers for ADUs intended to help increase the supply of rental units. Regarding livability and enhancing livability in the city. We administer the building code program, which attempts to provide safe living space for people. The number of permits that we saw in 2016 and 17 was 13,013. 54% of those were issued same day over the counter. Land use services also addresses livability. The main purpose of many of our zoning code regulations relate to livability. And then there's the enforcement program responding to zombie houses, which have been a big problem around the city, impacting livability, as well as illegal camping. 10 foreclosure sale properties with approximately $737,000 in revenue generated to the city across all bureaus. We also administer the what's called the EDP program, which is Extremely Distressed Properties Enforcement Program, which deals with abatement and demolition of properties with chronic nuisances and housing conditions that create risks of fire and public health hazards. In 2016 and 17, we inspected 5,080 housing units and derelict buildings. The Enhanced Rental Inspections Program also helps with livability around the city. Inspections of additional rental units at sites where violations are chronically found. And we're also developing a new program that's going to assist people around the city who find themselves in a violation situation where they've done work without permit to legalize the work that's been done. Another program relates to equity in our services as well as our work internally. We have a 5-year racial equity plan that we're implementing. We've got a lot of momentum and energy in the Bureau around this and have done a lot of equity training related to gender equity as well as equitable hiring practices. The enforcement program also has a strong equity component. We also do residential permit night, which provides services to homeowners who can't make it downtown to work with us during the regular business hours, and we serve about 30 to 40 customers each week. We're also developing a small business liaison program, which will be targeted toward women and minorities.
Good morning, Elshad Hajiev, Senior Business Operations Manager for the Bureau of Development Services. I'm going to cover some of the risks that the Bureau is facing. As you know, the Bureau is 99% fee-supported. Only 1% of our funding is coming from the general fund. The fees are coming from the building permits, mechanical permits, electrical permits.
Can you pull your mic a little bit closer?
Absolutely. These fees are collected through mechanical permits, electrical permits, building permits, land use fees and charges, and also enforcement penalties. The Bureau's reliance on fee revenues makes our projections of our revenues extremely important. So we are the only Bureau in the city who actually does econometric forecasting of our revenues besides the city budget office. We're also the only Bureau in the city that has a separate committee, a financial advisory committee, that actually looks at our projections of our revenues, projections of our expenditures, and provides us with recommendations as far as how to proceed with our 5-year financial plan. Over the last six, seven, 8 years, the economy has been expanding very rapidly, and we saw a huge increase in our revenues. Currently, our reserves stand at $90 million, which is the record for the Bureau. However, there is also a risk that at some point that expansion will stop, and we will face a recession or a mild correction. According to economists that staff our financial advisory committee, within 18 months to 2 years, there is no risk of immediate recession. However, after that, they're not sure as far as what will happen. So, with that in mind, the Bureau has a lot of the Bureau has a plan as far as how to mitigate those risks to our revenues. We experienced a recession back in 2008 and 9 when the Bureau lost more than half of its staff. So back then, we started working on our business continuity plan, which we completed. We presented it to the council. Council approved it. That plan tracks leading indicators in the construction activity within the Bureau and also separate triggers. Those include things like the amount of our reserves, the rate of the cost recovery for our services. We also look at number of permits that are coming into the door, the valuation. So all of those triggers are tracked on a monthly basis, and then they're shared with the senior management. And the plan also outlines measures that if any of those triggers are activated, what kind of measures the Bureau will take to prevent a situation that we were in back in 2008, 2009. That's one of the risks. The second risk is staff actually hiring and staffing our positions. Over the years, we've been asking for positions, and we're actually asking for another 16 positions in the spring bump. We have some difficulties filling those positions and actually finding qualified candidates. What happened during the recession is that a lot of trade programs and local universities were shut down. And just like 3 to 4 years ago, they started to add those programs. However, the Bureau is still a champion in hiring. We hired 109 new employees just last calendar year, which actually represent 20% of our staff. So we're hiring at a very high rate. Not only adding positions that creates vacancies, but also we're dealing with the aging workforce. When more than 35% of our employees actually are retirement age or close to retirement, so there is a high level of attrition. That's kind of makes the issue a little bit more challenging for us. However, again, the Bureau implemented so many creative ways of dealing with that challenge. We have a dedicated HR analyst that's assigned to our Bureau. We also have a very robust hiring process. Again, we pulled some statistics. The Bureau is actually, as far as the average time to fill the position, we are the lowest in the city across the bureaus. And again, we renew our workforce at a pretty high rate, 20%, which is really high. Again, we also have different staffing contracts with agencies where we bring temporary employees to help us deal with the workload and with our timelines. These are our challenges, and that's how we're dealing with them. With that, I'm going to turn over to Director Issel.
So last April, we had a GATOR process, which stands for Government Accountability, Transparency, and Results, and looked at the fees associated with development as well as the timelines. And we're going to be making another report back to the mayor and commissioner April 2nd on progress made there. So I won't spend too much time on that right now, but we have been making progress. We've been partnering with PHB to get their projects prioritized, and we're piloting some process changes associated with that to see if we can improve our turnaround times with permit review. We've started convening meetings of the directors of the bureaus who have staff involved in the permitting process, and are trying to break down the silos between those agencies to help address staffing challenges and consolidate our work when developing new development fees. That's been a complaint from the development community, is that we're too siloed in our approach with permitting, so we're working to break that down. The bureaus that are going to be increasing fees and bringing those fee proposals to you this spring, those are going to include information so that you can look at them holistically and know what the full impact will be to a development project, whether it's a new single-family home or a new office project or apartment project. We are also working on improving timelines as far as wait times in the Development Services Center. generated over 40 ideas from staff, both in our bureau and our interagency partners, and are working on prioritizing those and implementing them. We're also working on POPS, which is our technology project. It's going to allow us to do electronic plan review, which will increase our efficiency as well as be a lot more convenient for our customers that they don't have to drive downtown to submit plans. They'll also be able to make their payments for these permits online and not have to make a trip downtown. And it will improve access to information by the community about development projects in their neighborhoods. That concludes our presentation. If you have any questions for us.
I have a question, and it's a little more high level, but so you do permitting for new buildings and stuff.
Yes.
And so through that process, you know, or have a reasonable expectation based on the permits that you grant and the timelines for the construction that results for that. For new housing or new commercial construction, you have an idea of how long it will be before, say, new commercial property of such and such a size is going to be brought online within a given area, and you have information on how many market rate housing units are going to be available over a timeline going forward, and you know how many affordable housing units are going to be available going forward. So is that information something that you have available to the public and or council, and do you have that kind of plotted over time as you...
I have it here if you would like.
I would like, as a matter of fact. But what I'm trying to get a sense of is, I mean, the city knows that we're undergoing this extremely vexing housing issue, and it's reflected in a lot of different ways, and as we read the reports, a lot of bureaus are being affected by it, as are the people who live in Portland and the metro area. And I'm trying to get a sense of the larger issue of this is a crisis, but is it ever going to not be a crisis? And it, for us to make that transition, I mean, at some point, a crisis becomes the new normal. And I'm going to be talking about this again, as you might expect, when we're in the context of other bureaus. But I'm just, you guys are in a position to sort of see what the future looks like. I want to see forecasting, really, when it comes to housing availability and to get a better sense of, I'm sure this is something that maybe council already knows, but if they don't, they definitely want to know, is when the crisis is going to be mitigated to a level where we can start making adjustments. I understand that a lot of the homelessness funding and JOH and all that other stuff is kind of sunsetted after a certain amount of time, like 6 years or something like that. So, I mean, if it's still a crisis in 6 years, that's not going to be a way. We need to have a systemic way of dealing with it. I know that that's what council has been trying to do, but this seems to be the place where we can get at least one of the pieces of data that we need to understand when there might be some relief.
I'm actually very concerned about the amount of affordable housing on the horizon. We did have a rush of applications in just prior to February 1st, 2017, right when the inclusionary housing regulations went into effect. And from that time, we have approximately 10,000 units in 81 projects in the pipeline. Whether all of those continue forward, we don't know. The cost of construction also is very high right now and impacting project feasibility. Since February 1, 2017, when those regulations went into effect, we have only had approximately 17 projects in that are subject to inclusionary housing. Also, we've seen a drop-off in land use reviews and early assistance appointments and pre-application conferences, which are the front end of the pipeline, the canary in the coal mine, so to speak. And we've we're seeing a drop-off there. So I'm concerned about how those regulations are calibrated and if they need to be relooked at sooner rather than later. Tyler Bump from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability produced a report in February of this year looking back. There's debate in the development community about if it's working, if it's not working, and if it's calibrated right. So I expect there will be more discussion with Council and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability and the development community on what to do and how to assess whether we're getting the results and whether it's going to work.
I just want to make sure I'm reading this right. The ones that are in the category of projects not subject to IH, the 2952 units, those are market rate?
They're all market rate as far as I know. Yeah.
Or luxury.
Or luxury. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's not good.
Just a quick question, your staffing needs. It sounds like you're having a real challenge with staffing, and I noticed in the report you talk about collaborating with community colleges. Are you collaborating with high schools? I know at David Douglas we're starting a new construction program next year, and it seems like from our experience with training and trying to direct kids into fields is getting them earlier and explaining the wide range. And I doubt if getting into doing the permitting for the city is in that curriculum. I really do. It's more about electrical, plumbing. But it's just a suggestion to make sure that's put in the curriculum so they can start thinking about it early on, because not everyone wants to be out in the cold all the time. And it might help with your staffing needs. It's more of a long-range thing than a short-range, but we're finding with our teaching shortage of teachers of color, we're starting quite young and getting them into programs to get them to consider being a teacher. So the same thing might happen by starting much younger.
Thank you for that. That's also on my list to do this year. To get out to schools and talk to kids about, especially students of color, about career opportunities with us in our harder-to-fill career paths, both building inspectors and plans examiners. We're having a really difficult time finding qualified applicants, and I know we need to start young before even we want to partner with the colleges, but also get out to the high schools. Thank you.
We're also working on an internal career ladder. I mean, I don't want to go too deep into this because it's not relevant to the budget conversation right now, as well as I'm in the early stages of working with BHR, talking to BHR about a continuing education pilot program for our bureau. But I love the idea of going out to schools for sure. Career day.
Mayor, just I wanted to echo actually something that Elshad mentioned, and I want to make sure Council's aware of it. And I think that, you know, he talked about the Bureau is in really good financial shape right now, and I think it is, but it won't last forever. And there have been some significant changes. Last year, Council eliminated the general fund support of the land use program, and this year, BDS and the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability came to an agreement to share 35%, am I right, of some fee revenue for some planning positions, which are appropriate, and I think there are good reasons for those decisions. But it does mean that the reserves in the land use program, will drop, very low. And to the extent there's a slowdown, it will put additional pressure on the Bureau. And so I think there were good reasons for those decisions, and it helped us overall in terms of the city budget. I do just want to make sure Council is aware of that. And one of the things we note in here is just to really closely monitor as the future as we go forward, both development activity and the overall size of those reserves in case they do dip into territories that we're uncomfortable with. So.
Very good. Frieda.
One quick question I noticed I had known. With your violators, the fees, the ones that are non-compliance, their penalties, does anyone know what the collection rate is on those penalties?
It's actually quite low. The goal of the program is not to penalize, but actually to bring violators to compliance. So a lot of times those fees are actually either waived, or if someone doesn't pay, we have chronic violators that keep on paying and not paying and not paying. So then we assess liens on their properties. So so there are two things there. So first of all, it's really about bringing them to compliance. So sometimes fees are not even charged. If when they charged, a lot of